On this episode of Skeptico, atheist and author of Why Truth Matters, Ophelia Benson.
Christopher Hitchens, as we all know, is admirably insisting that, he's not going to change his opinions about the nature of the world and about whether or not there's a God just because he's mortally ill. And if there are any rumors that he's done a deathbed conversion, he wants it to be on the record right now that that's not what he considers the real Christopher Hitchens.
But I don't know where you go with that either. I mean, I don't know how you can a priori say, I'm not going to have a deathbed conversion, no matter what I say at the time of my death. You know, I mean, that's kind of...
I know it's sort of tricky in a way. But on the other hand, I kind of think we all do have a right to do that.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, I have an interview with Ophelia Benson, author, atheist, and editor of the very popular and very well-done Butterflies and Wheels website. Now, this interview didn't really go the way that I planned, but when I was editing it, I realized that maybe it really made the point I was trying to make after all, and that's just to demonstrate how this new science of consciousness that we've been exploring so much on this show in terms of near-death experience or medium communication and psi phenomena, how that new science is making its way into the marketplace of ideas. So how a public intellectual like Ophelia Benson is processing this. And in that respect, I think the interview is quite revealing. So listen in to my interview with Ophelia Benson. Today we're joined by the author of Does God Hate Women? And Why Truth Matters. She's also the editor of a very popular Butterflies and Wheels website, which espouses the view that truth is important and that to tell the truth about the world, it's necessary to put aside whatever preconceptions, ideological, political, moral, etc., one brings to the endeavor. Ophelia Benson, welcome to Skeptico.
Thank you.
Well, it's very nice to have you on. And, you know, as we were just chatting about there, I've really enjoyed digging into your writing and listened to a couple of interviews. Let's start with this Why Truth Matters question, because I think it's going to be interesting to our listeners. You know, at first brush, it might seem rhetorical, especially to folks who listen to this show, since we spend so much time trying to tear apart the latest science and understand what's real and what isn't. But it's actually a pretty deep question, and it's has some complexity that I was hoping you could flesh out a little bit. So when it comes to scientific inquiry, especially about controversial science, unpopular topics, why does the truth matter? And before you answer, let me stick another part on the end of that. You know, at the same time, does it maybe matter a little bit less than we thought it did? I mean, do we have to make a little room at the table for our postmodernist friends in this discussion as well?
Well, we did talk about that a good deal, not surprisingly, in the book, Why Truth Matters. And I don't feel much impulse to give room to our postmodernist friends, frankly, but I do feel some need to give considerable room to the idea that truth doesn't always matter, that there are times and situations and subjects on which it isn't necessarily the thing one wants, and it doesn't necessarily hurt anything to be looking for something else. I mean, sometimes you know, the truth about our existential condition doesn't make any difference to anybody else, and isn't necessarily the thing we want to keep a grip on at some particular moment. Sometimes you need to be excessively optimistic in order to act at all. Excessively optimistic in the sense that you're somewhat inaccurately optimistic. So there are all kinds of life situations in which truth doesn't necessarily matter more than other things.
Sure. And there's the psychology of optimism and all that stuff. I just think I don't find a lot of comfort in that. You know, I mean, I don't know.
Well, I don't either, but on the other hand, you know, one can always think, well, I haven't been tested in some particular way.
Sure.
And, you know, and it depends what you're talking about. I mean, Christopher Hitchens, as we all know, is admirably insisting that, you know, he's not going to change his opinions about the nature of the world and about whether or not there's a God just because he's mortally ill. And if there are any rumors that he's done a deathbed conversion, he wants it to be on the record right now that that's not what he considers the real Christopher Hitchens.
But I don't know where you go with that either. I mean, I don't know how you can a priori say, I'm not going to have a deathbed conversion no matter what I say at the time.
It's sort of tricky in a way. But on the other hand, I think I kind of think we all do have a right to do that. You know, if you've been a lifelong atheist and are continuing to be an atheist, I think you have a right to say, well, okay, you know, if at the last minute I mumble something, I want to go on the record right now saying I repudiate that in advance. And, you know, well, it's ours, so I think we get to do that.
Yeah, maybe. And I want to get into that because okay. I think even that is kind of laden with some contradictions. I mean, I don't know why we'd want to take a position or you'd want to take a position. Anyone who's seeking the truth would want to take a position that this is my belief and it can't be changed no matter what the evidence. You know, I don't think that's what you're saying, but let me sharpen this up a little bit for people before we jump right into the middle of things, which I love to do and usually wind up doing anyway. But giving it a little bit of a framework here to what you're talking about, because one of the examples you use frequently, and it's a good one about this why truth matters, is this Holocaust deniers, right? So we can look at Holocaust deniers and it cuts through all the crap. They're on one side of the truth equation and the rest of us are on another, and that's pretty simple. But the rest of it, a lot of times, isn't that simple. And one of the examples I've brought up on this show many times, and you've written about, and it was really the first way that I even came across your writing, to be honest with you, was on Freud, you know? So we take Sigmund Freud, we take the data, the truth in terms of him really being little more than a charlatan, you know, who manufactures cases to support very controversial, unsustainable theories that are now completely discredited. But the myth and the influence that he has, while admittedly, you know, it's in decline, you know, it persists. I've been surprised actually on this show in speaking with some very pretty prominent guests, and this topic will somehow come up. And I'll invariably get this, well, I don't know about that, but he's still without a doubt one of the most influential figures in the 20th century. And I want to say, yeah, isn't that part of the problem? I mean,
exactly.
We've done everything we can to discredit this guy, and he's still very influential.
Yeah. I think that's very interesting. And I hear that and see that a lot, too, and that there is this kind of weird clinging to something about him, some essence of Freud that we still have to pay deference to, and it has now boiled down to, well, at least he was influential. Well, yeah, but all kinds of people have been influential, and that's not really evidence either of the quality of their thought or of their ability to get at the truth of anything.
Exactly. And maybe that does tie into the other topic, and the main topic I really wanted to talk about today, and that's how atheists, progressives, critical thinkers, skeptics, and they're different people there. I'm not trying to unnecessarily label them together, but lump them together. But whatever term you choose, I see more and more, especially in the work that we've done on this show, falling into the same kind of truth trap, you know, that's truth with a capital T, that they so rail against. Because it really, at the end, comes down to, how do we really find out what's true? And I see this same news today, you know, the guy who's going to burn the Quran, right? We see some idiotic, fundamentalist religious belief. And in this case, it's not getting a total free pass in the marketplace of ideas. But underneath it, it is, because we're kind of dealing with it seriously. And the White House is issuing statements saying, gee, I wish you wouldn't do that. And General Petraeus is saying, you know, that could harm our troops. Instead of somebody saying, you're a complete idiot. And, you know, anyone who's following you is deluded. So,
well, but at the same time, people who get extremely upset about that, there's a certain amount of idiocy in that too. Now, I would give the guy the exact same advice that everybody else is: don't do it, because you know perfectly well that this makes other people's buttons flare extremely red and get extremely upset. But, you know, if you draw back a few steps and think about it, both sides are bat loony. Because, you know, if you burn a book, you're just burning one particular artifact, and it really doesn't matter to anything. And if there is a God, even God wouldn't care that much. He would just say, the poor erring human doesn't know what he's up to.
I hear you on that. I just think it does get us into this reactionary mode. And whatever side you're on, there's this need. We got to fight back. We got to stop this. And that's what I hear from atheists, or I see from atheists. And as they spill over into the critical thinking, skeptical community, it's the same thing. You know, we have to stop these guys. And to me, it really makes it harder to get at the really big question, which is, what's really true? What is science telling us? So for me, the little journey that I've been in my tiny little corner of the world here is to really look at the science behind some of these controversial science things that are on the fringe, really related to big picture questions. When you talk to the scientists, when you talk to the researchers, here's what I find out. I find two things that I think should be at the center of all these discussions and yet are never even at the table. And one is that science is revealing that our mind, our consciousness, is not, as we used to believe, reducible to just brain function. There seems to be something more than just brain function going on. And number two, without getting into too much of the science of this, because I didn't bring you on here to have a real scientific debate, but really to have a more of a dialogue about how these forces, how these ideas might work their way into or be rejected by our marketplace of ideas. But the second major point is that consciousness, in some way that we can't completely understand or explain, seems to survive our bodily death. And those two things together have really, really deep implications for all these issues, and yet they never seem to be tackled head on in any way in terms of saying, gee, is there really something true at the heart of this guy who's trying to burn the Quran and the guys who are going to be mad at the burning of the Quran? Is there anything about their experience, their spiritual experience, that might actually be scientifically credible? Because if there is, even a bit, I think the dialogue needs to be really different.
Yeah, that makes sense. What I don't know anything about this research that shows that consciousness, that some part of consciousness survives bodily death. Do you have any names off the top of your head?
Well, are you at all familiar with any of the near-death experience research?
Yeah, a little bit.
So who? I mean, we've had virtually all of them on this show. So from Raymond Moody to Jeffrey Long to the people at the University of Virginia, Bruce Grayson, to, and a lot of the skeptical folks who don't even really do a lot of research but are just kind of skeptical. And really, the state of the science is medically inexplicable accounts of something happening when it shouldn't be happening. And I think the evidence, if you go to point one, which is that our consciousness is somehow not reducible to our brain function, is even more well established. I mean, there's plenty of people who fight tooth and nail against this, but if you really go and look at the science and the majority of the cutting edge science, and even the people who, you know, get together at these conferences on consciousness, you know, they would back away very quickly to the idea that, hey, this is all just our brain and we can reduce it all down to brain function.
Well, do they back away from it, or do they just say that we don't yet have all the information about exactly how it works? I mean, I know there are a lot of people who think there's a big gap between what we know and a really complete explanation of how the mind is what the brain does, for instance. I mean, is it that, or is it more than that?
It's funny, Ophelia, because I spend an equal amount of time talking to Christian folks, or religious folks, spiritual folks, and find out how their traditions and their ideas are just as resistant to this new science as people on the other side. And they are, you know. I mean, I just talked to Oxford professor Michael Marsh, who's was a lecturer at Oxford in medical science. He's a doctor and also has a PhD from Oxford as a theologian. So he gets to object to the whole near-death experience science on both sides. You know, he says, hey, as a doctor, I don't buy it. And also, as a theologian, they couldn't be talking to God because Jesus wouldn't talk like that to people. Well, his arguments fall apart just like they do for all the other skeptics, but they fall apart on both sides. But what I was going to say about your last comment is it's this, again, arguing from the gaps thing, you know. So if you want to take that stance and saying, well, we just haven't figured it out yet. Yeah, the data that's coming in totally contradicts our medical understanding and the model we've built of how the brain works. But you know what? We'll figure it out in time. Well, that's not really how the game is played. The game is played, the science game is played, that we have to come up with theories that incorporate in the data that we have. And when we have data that falls outside of that, we have to expand our theories to incorporate in that data. And that's just the state that we're in if you look at this. I mean,
yeah, sure. I'm just not aware of all this data that can't be accounted for.
Well,
but
I'm not, are you familiar with Richard Wiseman, Dr. Richard Wiseman?
Mm-mm, no.
Okay, well, he's pretty prominent skeptic. I mean, even his quote is really telling. He says remote viewing, and then when he was pressed, he goes on to say all these psi phenomena, ESP phenomena, telekinesis phenomena. And this is a paraphrase, but it's almost a direct quote. He said, in any other field of science, we'd have enough evidence to accept them as true, but that begs the question, do we need a higher standard of evidence for this kind of phenomena? So, I mean, here's from an arch skeptic. So, I mean, that'll give you a little bit of a sense of where we're really at on this stuff. And you got to admit, just from a philosophical standpoint, that's not a very strong argument to say, well, gee, these guys have proven it by the normal means that we have, but do we need a higher standard for them since...
Well, except I didn't hear him say that anybody's proven it.
Well, he said in any other field of science, we would consider it proven.
Proven?
Well, yeah.
Not just backed up or justified, but proven?
Well, aren't we just kind of splitting hairs there? I mean...
No, because proof is a very high standard. You don't actually prove things in science.
Right. So if we say that something is, you know, well-established scientifically,
yeah, okay.
Aren't we saying... Right?
That's the kind of thing I was asking about.
Right. I mean, I can dig up the exact quote. I've used it several times on the show. It's really easy to find. I can Google it and get...
No, that's okay. But because I haven't seen any of this research, I'm sort of not in a position to answer your argument because I don't know the particulars of what it's based on.
Right. There isn't a lot we can really grab onto or talk about. But to a certain extent, it kind of proves my point. I mean, how can this stuff fly so far beneath the radar? How can, you know, so you look at the continuation of consciousness, and it comes from a number of different ways, right? So it comes from near-death experience research, which they do in hospitals, right, under highly controlled...
It's all within about 2 minutes after brain death, right?
The brain can only, you know, the whole resuscitation process is only really viable within a pretty short window. It's not
right,
2 minutes.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So
that
means that they're not really showing that consciousness survives death, doesn't it? If they have only this tiny narrow window to work in, they're still working within the biological body.
Right, but Ophelia, in every way that we have of measuring brain activity, we can verify that folks are no longer, their brain is no longer working. So any conscious experience they would have during that time is completely medically inexplicable and beyond our understanding of what, you know, being conscious in our body means.
Well, except that the different parts of the body take different lengths of time to die. So the body isn't completely dead yet. And by definition, that's true because you're talking about people who've been resuscitated, right?
Right.
Or aren't you? Does this happen... during death, and then the people go ahead and die.
Most of the research that folks like to quote most frequently is done when people are resuscitated in the hospital after cardiac arrest. But I'm not sure I totally understand what you're saying there. The reason they do cardiac arrest is because we know the whole physiological experience of death pretty good when it comes to cardiac arrest. I mean, when your brain stops within 10 to 15 seconds, I mean, when your heart stops, I should say, within 10 to 15 seconds, we know that your brain is no longer active electrically. So we wouldn't have any theory for how you could be having a conscious experience without your brain functioning. This is the central scientific question, it would seem to me, that underlies all these issues, is what is real, what is the truth. Even if you, you know, don't accept what I'm saying, it still seems to me to be the central question, right? Whether you're coming, and it also is the central question for theology as well. I mean, if you have some kind of religious belief, and I think that's why theologians are so resistant to accepting this science too, because it violates their cherished ideas and beliefs about exactly how this stuff happens, and the thought that science might penetrate this veil of death to any extent is very threatening, because it adds a certain legitimacy that would, you know, trump, hey, my ancient book says it's this way or that way.
But the science is on the radar, isn't it? I mean, this stuff is not, it's been recorded and reported and discussed, hasn't it?
Well, it isn't on your radar, and I'm not singling you out. I mean, I'm a little bit surprised it isn't more on your radar. But then again, I think this is the condition that we're in. I mean, it should be. It should be central. It should be the thing that we need to most concentrate on and figure out, rather than worrying about the guy burning the Quran, you know? I mean, the question is really, what's true about this? Is any of it true? Because it certainly passes the initial test of, you know, is there anything here? Well, yeah, I mean, there's something here. There's major doctors at major hospitals across Europe and across the United States who are observing, reporting, slicing and dicing the data in every way possible and all that. So, I mean, there's something going on. Why isn't it the central focus?
Well, I think the reason is that the majority of scientists think they know what's going on, which is that the body isn't fully dead yet, and that parts of the brain are still generating visions, hallucinations, brain states of some sort.
Okay, I'm going to cut it off there for a minute. You can see that Ophelia, Miss Benson, is kind of out in the weeds there a little bit. It's logically inconsistent with what we just talked about. And you could argue that, you know, I should have sent her more information, more NDE research before this interview. But I kind of think not. You know, I think it's interesting to see how someone who's a public intellectual, obviously a very smart person, how they process this NDE science, which is certainly out there. I mean, it's in our kind of cultural mix, and people have heard about it and know about it. So it's interesting to see how they process it kind of cold. And it's equally interesting to see how they process it once they're warmed up to it. In that, you know, I certainly sent her follow-up information. I sent her the lit review from Dr. Bruce Grayson at the University of Virginia. And I've published that before on the Skeptico website, and I might provide a link to it again in these show notes. But it really is a really nice, comprehensive lit review. I certainly haven't heard from Miss Benson since then, and I don't suspect it will. If you've listened to this show, you've seen this pattern over and over again. When skeptics get confronted with real data that they don't like or is radically different from their worldview, you don't hear too much from them. And I don't suspect I'll hear much from Miss Benson on any of this NDE research. But let me pick up the interview, because we did touch on another topic that's important to me, and that's how Christians and the Christian tradition is dealing with this new science of consciousness and how that fits into this science, religion, culture war that we hear so much about. So here goes. You know, the other part that I find fascinating about this, and maybe you can comment on, but, you know, the dirty little secret of the New Testament scholars, the New Testament scholars, the folks who are more atheistic. So, you know, the Bart Ehrman or the Robert Price, if you know Bob Price, he was on the show a couple episodes back, and very, very smart guy, funny guy, entertaining guy, very competent New Testament scholar, and also an atheist. But the kind of dirty little secret, if you really read, is from a historical perspective, we have to accommodate the idea that these visions, these kind of experiences, these kinds of miracles are well attested historically. Now, they're not well attested in the way that, you know, Christians might want to fit them in, or they'd want to take this one and leave those ones out. But from a historical perspective, even the historians who are atheistic agree that from the normal means that we have for looking at history, analogy, and how well the accounts are, you know, corroborated by different sources, we've got a lot of miracles there that we have to deal with. And that this idea of...
Wait. Historians agree to that?
Well, the New Testament scholars like Bob Price and people of that ilk, and I'd imagine other folks who you'd... You know, I mean, this is really what you find from the Jesus Project, if you really read what they're saying. I mean, mm-hmm. the arguments are over whether or not... You know, for example, if you take the resurrection of Jesus, you know, you'll take Bart Ehrman, who's not a believer and one of the foremost New Testament scholars, or Bob Price, who's not a believer, one of the foremost New Testament scholars, or you take somebody like Marcus Borg, who was on the Jesus Project, is still a Christian, but accepts, you know, this reimagining of what Christianity is. Well, all of them accept the idea that Jesus lived. They all accept that as a historical fact, and they accept as a historical fact. And we can't say historical fact, because historians, when they look back, they just say these things are probably true or probably not true. They don't have a time machine where they can go back and say that. So they just say probably true, probably not true. But what they say is probably true is that these different people had an encounter with someone who was dead. In this case, it was Jesus. They had some kind of experience that they thought was very real with someone who died. So, I mean, that has to be incorporated in it, and yet it's kind of glossed over, depending on which side, you know, glossed over if you're of that ilk and you want to kind of see things that way.
Yeah, it doesn't seem glossed over to me. It's more a matter of saying that having an experience that you think is X is not the same thing as actually having the experience of X.
Yeah, maybe.
The people who saw Jesus, could have been hallucinating it. Plus, the record differs in different accounts, and it's not none of them are historical accounts as normally understood.
Well, now, you know, there's a couple different things to tease out there. Yeah, there's differences. Yeah, there's contradictions. But, you know, this is a pretty well, for that much of ancient history, we have pretty good records. We have pretty good testimony on the different accounts in terms of what historians would normally piece together. And
I'm not sure that's right. The way I understand it is that Mark is the earliest one, and Mark doesn't say anything about a vision, and the other stuff came after that and was a development of it. So it was basically confabulation. It was storytelling.
Okay, I'm going to cut it off again here, because on this show, we haven't talked too much about this New Testament scholarship stuff, and it can get really geeky and really detailed. I think it's interesting, and I hope to explore it from some new, fresh angles, particularly how it might relate back to these more modern scientific discoveries about consciousness. But since I haven't gone into that too much in the past on the show, I don't think it's really appropriate to dig into it here. Now, I don't really agree with Ophelia and where she's coming from, and we spend a good deal of time on the phone talking about Catholic miracles and about different New Testament scholars and whether the visions of resurrection were real or whether they were even attested and all of that. And let me reiterate, I don't have any kind of theological dog in that fight. I just think it's interesting, and it is something we'll cover again. But since we haven't really covered in the past, I think that the discussion is all that interesting. So this interview, while it didn't quite go the way I expected, I think may turn out to be a nice turning point in this continued dialogue I want to have with you about how these discoveries in consciousness are impacting both science and religion. So I hope you'll stay with me for that. In the meantime, I want to thank Ophelia Benson for joining me today on Skeptico. I sure hope you'll check out her website, butterfliesandwheels.org. Very, very good stuff on there, and I really enjoy writing style, and some of the content she brings there is really excellent. If you'd like more information about this show, please check out the Skeptico website. It's at skeptiko.com. You'll find links to all our previous shows, an email link to me, and a link to our forum. Well, that's going to about do it for today. Until next time, bye for now.